We are continuing our interview with Astrid Oppenheimer. Today is the 26th of April, 88. We are on behalf of the Oral History Program, the National Council of Jewish Women, Pittsburgh session. Astrid is one of the sessions, one before the last one. We are. The interview is by Howard Broom and Aviva Karev, myself. Now, Asher, we want to continue about the wars, as we say informally, about glories, about what happened, because we want to end this time with all the wars and everything that you dealt with in Israel, and we want to arrive to a point that we talk only about your work and this work, and this will be our last session. So please continue telling about this area.
Let's say first about glory. There is no glory in war, only in retroactive, in retrospect. During the time that we fought for survival in 1948, 1949, and later on in 56 and 67, which are the wars that I participated, it was really a war for the survival of the Jewish Yishuv in Israel and later the Israeli state. I really don't remember exactly what we thought this the last time, but I might just say that before Israel was declared as a state, after the United Nations, as it was called, what was it called? Before the UN, it had another name. But anyway.
Protector?
No. The United Nations had another name at that time. I think.
Yes, it did. It did.
When it was voted that to make Israel a state, at that point, Israel didn't have an army to speak of, and of course, the main resource was the Haganah. Were people who already had some rank in the Haganah, and people that were in the British Army or in some other army. So, when the State of Israel was declared, it was a very small group of people that could be mobilized. To this group came the volunteers from the Western, from the United States, from from Europe, free Europe, and then after the state came into being, the stream of refugees came from Europe. Those were people usually after concentration camps, people who were already in bad shape anyway, but they came and they were sent to camps. I'm talking about the men. The young men were sent to military camps to prepare them to fight for the State of Israel. It took only a few days after the declaration of the State of Israel and the dancing in the street that the Arab armies came and attacked Israel from all sides. And it really was some kind of a miracle that the Israelis were able to withstand the onslaught of all those armies. There's not much more than rifles, submachine guns, mortars where the artillery. There was an Israeli made mortar called the Victor, who made big noise. I think I said that already last time. But it's so long ago. Okay. And anyway, the Arab armies were thrown back, and Israel won that first war of independence. At that time, I was in the infantry and participated in the conquering of Jaffa, Salame, Ramle, Lod, Abu Ghosh, which was really this was an Arab village in which the Arabs were on the side of the Israelis anyway, so we had nothing to worry about. And I went up to Jerusalem. I remember I told you also about that that we had to go up to the Mount Scopus with a convoy and had to stay there. We were with war police uniform. I'm just now remembering again what we were talking about.
You did. You recovered this very well. I remember the same city, Jaffa, Ramle, Lod.
I don't know if I told you about that. You might remember better, but because for you this was something that you never heard before. The one time we went to a little Arab village called Milin. Well, it was a village. It was like a village. It was about 20. It was already. It was between. There was a apuga. I don't know how you call it. It was like a hole of between the two, the first part of the war and the fighting and the second part.
A lull.
Yeah, but it was an official lull. It was that was agreed upon by all sides. And as a matter of fact, there's something interesting that I don't think I mentioned it the last time. When the lull was supposed to go into effect at 8 o'clock in the morning, and we were in somewhere in the our line was at a certain point, and we got orders in the middle of the night to move forward as much as we can, because each acre or each dunam that we could take is would have been to our advantage, and we were able to advance for maybe 12 kilometers at that night. Yeah. There were no Arabs around. We saw the right in the front line. We were sitting there with the weapons. Obviously, they instead of doing the same thing, they didn't have the stecher. So they ran away, and we were able to advance and take some more
ground.
Now that then we had between the two
you moved 12 kilometers. Where were you and where to where? Because that's kind of significant.
If I would remember that, I would tell you that it had to be it had to be in the
Jerusalem area?
No. And you maybe, what is that called? Gaza, on the way to Jerusalem, there is this one part that stayed in Air Pen, right inland. It was a real bad fighting there, and I forgot the name of it. It was, anyway, it was about 10 miles from Ramle, past Ramle on the way to Jerusalem.
Okay.
You don't remember that? You were a little girl then.
Gezer. I know where there's a kibbutz there.
Gezer is a kibbutz. Yeah, yeah. But there is also a monastery there.
Yeah, the monastery is.
Who have good wine.
Okay, I go there every time.
Yes,
I know. But then I know exactly the spot.
Yeah. But I don't remember the name. I'm surprised it's quite a while.
Yeah, I'm surprised too, because I stopped.
But I might remember later.
Okay,
so we took some of the land there. Now, there is a place called Milin, and that's from there about 20 kilometers inside the earth territory that was still in air tents, and somehow the Israeli army headquarters decided that there should be like a strafing. They should go, we should go and even teach them a lesson there. And we were supposed to go, I mean we went, and we were supposed to go and detonate some of the houses to destroy them. So, and it was really an impressive thing because it was far. I mean, to go that far into enemy territory was no easy thing. I was one of the squad after squad comes a platoon. I was a platoon commander at that time. And the in charge of, we went to platoon, and we had a young man who was in charge of the operation. I remember his name, Raphael Lifshitz. I think he got killed later on. He was a real daredevil. He was in charge of the. He was killed in a traffic accident. He was driving like crazy. But there, we went all on foot. We had engineers with us. They carried on their back all this TNT. There were probably 10 of them, 10 engineers, and each one had about 25 kilo of TNT. And if a bullet hits that,
you blow up.
And we went to that meeting. We had nothing, no resistance. All the way, nobody even noticed that. We came to Milin, and that, if you want to talk about glory, this is glory, the way everyone behaved. I mean, those were just regular Jewish boys. And some of them really, they were after concentration camps, and they some of those were really not afraid of anything, some of those people who came from the camps. Others were afraid of their own shadow. But we went there and we came into this Nilin, and there was
Nilin?
Nilin, N-I-L-I-N. And there was one house in which they some Arab group was located. The engineers with a part of my platoon went forward under that building. They didn't notice because they didn't expect anything. It was so far inland, they didn't expect anything. And they blew up that building. That was the first bang that was in this whole operation. After that, we went right into that village. We took all the civilians out of the houses and we assembled them and we told them, "Don't worry, nothing is going to happen to you." And we really death slow to treat the Arab children and women the way we did. And the whole thing was over in about 15 minutes. We left. Mm-hmm. Nothing happened until about halfway. We heard some Arabs coming from the side, and they were trying to put up an ambush for us. Mm-hmm. But we heard them, so when we heard them, we stopped right away. Mm-hmm. And we noticed exactly they were very, I mean, they had no experience at all. Mm-hmm. They didn't know what they were doing. They were very loud about it. They were yelling to each other, "Here, come here." And we were just waiting until we knew exactly where they were. And we turned around, we went another way, and very quietly. and we came back. We didn't have one casualty. We didn't even shot that because we destroyed that one building before they knew what was going on, and we came back. But I think that if you want to talk about a glory, that's one of it. Because you have to remember that the soldiers in Rakhine that we had were not trained. They had their weapons were not first class. It was all old. We had old Lee-Enfield rifles. Lee-Enfield number 3 were our rifles. Heavy, heavy. The submachine guns were not Uzi. Uzi was prototype. It was made in Israel. It just was a butt and a barrel. That was the whole and a magazine, a real light submachine gun. That half the time, it was made after the Sten. The Sten submachine gun. Mm-hmm. That first of all was so dangerous. If you hit it on the ground, it would go off, and half the time it would stop in the middle. Mm-hmm. But for us, it was the best there was. If you consider that at that time, Piper planes were bombarding with hand grenades. And the biggest tank that we had in Israel was an old Hotchkiss. Those were real little tanks. So those were good weapons, and obviously they were good enough to consider that the Arabs were bad. And, I mean, the Arab soldier at that time was the worst that you can imagine. So I just don't know until where we got. If we got to the preparation of the Sinai campaign, I think I even, yes, we talked about that. I think I even said that I was involved in the bunker in the Israeli headquarters. At that time I was in the intelligence, and we had to have special badges to go down there, and because the whole building that was on top, the same building was below ground, wherever that was, and I don't even want to say exactly where that was. That means the same rooms and everything that was above ground and that we were familiar with was underground. And that's where we were when the preparations for the Sinai campaign were. I was instrumental in that because my job was to evaluate the Egyptian army. I really don't remember if we talked about the Egyptian army and
very little.
And
I can see
I meant the 6 day war, not the Sinai campaign. Sinai campaign was still very amateur. Between the Sinai campaign and the 6 day war, that's when the Israeli army really became an army, well organized and well equipped. Until then, it was more a partisanist group of people who fought for their survival. Well, the thing is, I really don't
know. What was your assignment in the Six-Day War? You started
in the Six-Day War. I was in charge of the Egyptian army, their equipment, I mean, to evaluate and to, I had to give figures and even sort different types of equipment. It was my, I worked on this for years before that. And the way the Egyptian army is going to function, the way they are going to set up their not their fighting unit, but their echelon, their
organization.
The organization table. And the strength of the unit, how many, even there were constantly questions coming in from the south, from the commanders in the south, how many rounds does this soldier carry, or what type of machine gun, what type of shells they have for the, what kind of ammunition, their artillery, if they are able to penetrate, but that was all, I mean, I didn't shake it out of my head, that was preparation but I was in charge of of that section of the Egyptian.
What was your rank?
Major. I was a major already.
How many players?
And a major in the Israeli army is now, I don't know, probably devaluated too, but at that time. There's inflation and everything in that too. The bigger the army gets, the higher the ranks go. But in the intelligence, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but a major had a big responsibility at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So.
It was your son?
Your son. I think I told you in the story, but now it's coming back to me, how it was decided that it was time to go because they were digging in and building underground airfields. Mm-hmm. It was all part of it. And really, the real heroes of the Six-Day War was the Israeli Air Force.
Yeah.
And the Air Force intelligence, because the Air Force intelligence knew exactly when to hit the Egyptians. That was after a weekend or a holiday. The whole Egyptian Air Force was on parade.
Mm-hmm.
The pilots and everybody were standing on parade, 8 o'clock in the morning. There was something special that they were supposed to hear from. Somebody was supposed to talk to in each camp, in each airfield. And that was the time when the Israelis came over and we're able in a matter of
minutes, an hour
or so, the war was over, really, because the rest, well, there were some problems with the Mittler and with the Israeli paratroopers had big resistance, but as soon as the Egyptians lost their air problem, the war was as good as over, and really the Egyptians, I wasn't there anymore, but the Egyptians paid the Israelis back in 73 when they started the war on Yom Kippur, which is the opposite on our side, that they let other people go on vacation, and they weren't ready just one day. Who thinks? I mean, every good Jew thinks that on Yom Kippur, God is taking care of the universe. And that's what happened. And that's exactly what happened in 67, when they were most vulnerable. That's when the Israel hit them.
Mm.
I probably also said the last time that we are right there in Sinai. I was with all of the other intelligence officers, and we were looking for equipment. Mainly, we were interested to see if they had any kind of a biological gas or atomic weapons. Because we had some intelligence that they were. We never found anything like that. I love it. The aftermath of the Six-Day War, and I have some pictures. I didn't bring them today, but I'll give you a few pictures the next time. You said in the beginning you want this
at the end.
That I mean, we ex- equipment was, there were three divisions in Sinai, in Sinai, three air divisions, Egyptian divisions. All this is the latest in Russian equipment. And they didn't even get to fight because they were hit right there while they were still moving into the Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
We went there in two vehicles.
In two what?
Two vehicles. This group of intelligence officers that went into Sinai. Oh, I also told you, I remember everything. I told you about that group of officers that went into the Sinai, and I had to prepare them. We had them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We went with two vehicles in there, into the Sinai. The intelligence group to find weapons or whatever they are. And by the time we left there, everybody had his own Russian jeep or his own vehicle. There was no problem. You just had to go and tell the switch, and they.